two endeavors. Kick it, boys. Good evening, Radio Land, and welcome to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. We also stream on the internet at cjsf.ca, or you can listen to us on TELUS HD channel 701. My name is Dan, and I'm back with you live. It's been a crazy ride the last little while. I know, I haven't been here in person, even if my voice still was. Speaking of voice, we have a great voice today in Canadian journalism. Kevin Donovan from the Toronto Star joined me on the phone to talk about Gomeshi, as well as the Toronto Star's overall role in investigative journalism in Canada. And you'll also hear from two local actors, Ryan McNeil Bolton and Malcolm Masters. They are the creators of the series Goons, which was a recent entry into CBC's Comedy Coup competition. So you'll hear more about that later on. That's our feature interview with the second half. And you'll be hearing from a great, great Canadian musician today, Cold Specs, stopped by to talk about her album Neuroplasticity. And we're going to start with one of her singles off that great new album, Neuroplasticity. This is the song Bodies at Bay.
Keep the bodies at bay, gun the house. Keep the bodies at bay, gun the house. Darling, all my love rage before it festers like a
thank you.
Cold Specs with Bodies at Bay off her brand new album Neuroplasticity. And you'll be hearing from Cold Specs a little later on in the program. Right now, though, my first guest is an award-winning investigative journalist with the Toronto Star. He was one of the team leaders on the team that broke the Rob Ford crack cocaine scandal, and he was recently one of two journalists, along with the independent journalist and blogger Jesse Brown, to break the allegations against CBC's Gian Gomeshi. He is Kevin Donovan, and he joined me on the phone from Toronto last week. Joined on the phone by award-winning investigative reporter and editor at the Toronto Star, Kevin Donovan. Kevin, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
I wanted to have you on in particular because you were one of the first people to break the story of Gian Gomeshi and Gomeshigate, as they're calling it. When did you first discover that something might be amiss?
Well, in May of this year, the Star was approached by a freelance reporter, Jesse Brown, who had received an email, and the email described some of the conduct of Mr. Gomeshi. He ended up talking to some people, brought some information to us, and then I run the investigative team at the Toronto Star, and then we started looking into Mr. Gomeshi's behavior. I did some interviews myself, as well as the work that Mr. Brown had done. And then by June, one of the things that's really important in these stories is you give the other side an opportunity to comment, so I reached out to Mr. Gomeshi, tried to interview him. He ended up asking for questions. I sent him questions, which he gave to his lawyer. And then that sort of went on throughout the summer. And then in September, ran into him at an event and questioned him some more there. And then we were still hoping to get more information to bolster the story of the allegations that we were pursuing. And then the news came out of CBC that he had been fired, and that's when we published the substantive part of the story, which continues.
In his post, as he calls it, the truth on Facebook, he said that you guys had done due diligence earlier, but had chosen not to publish. Did his admittance force your hand in any way to publish the allegations that were piling up against him?
Oh, not at all. Now, Mr. Gomeshi says a number of things on that, which I would say are not true, on his Facebook posting. No, that didn't at all. In fact, as soon as on the previous Friday, when we learned that he was taking a leave for a couple of days, our feeling was something was about to break, and so it was on by the Friday. We were already starting to pull more information together, talk to people, and so no, it had nothing to do with his Facebook posting. But he's entitled to say these things, and he did say them.
I'm curious, what do you think will happen to the CBC as a result of this? I mean, they've lost arguably their biggest name, but also more important is the fact that two employees had approached people at the CBC with these allegations and were sort of brushed aside. How will this incident affect CBC going forward, do you think?
Well, CBC has hired a lawyer to look into issues exactly like the ones you just raised, and I mean, there's going to be as often in a matter like this, there will be a report done and recommendations will be made. And I mean, the CBC is a publicly funded organization. They have to be held to quite a high standard of accountability. I assume that better checks and balances will be put in place. I think one of the other things, this is not a story just about the CBC. It's causing other organizations to sit up and take notice of something that quite frankly, I think people have become complacent about, how to deal with allegations of harassment and sexual violence. And I thought that that was something of the 70s and 80s, that people turning a blind eye to it. It appears it's not, and so we now see other things happening in the wake of this at other institutions.
And I, you know, it was at 9 or 10 women that I think had come forward, but I'm just reading today that actually there's now a man that has come forward and said that Gomeshi followed him in his university days, I believe it was. Have you come across any more men that have alleged assault against Gomeshi?
There are other allegations from both men and women that we're pursuing. And until we publish a story, we have a policy that yeah. that we don't talk about it. But it's certainly people are coming forward to the media. There are presumably other people that we do not know about who may be coming forward to the police. They don't share that information with us. I think this is the original publication of the story in the Star was a lightning rod, and that attracted people who have, you know, until now been quite silent about these allegations. And I mean, I think that's a good thing. We're trying to be careful to make sure that not just because somebody says something, it doesn't mean we're going to publish it. We have to do some due diligence to see if, you know, the person did know Mr. Gomeshi. You know, do they have text messages, emails, things like that?
One of the things that I find interesting about this case is that it sort of opened up a conversation about kink and sexual practices. And how do you think that aspect of the story will help the general public understand that community going forward, and also bring about a greater reporting of sexual assault?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of questions there. The one about the community, I assume you mean the BDSM community, they're not too pleased to be brought into this story by Mr. Gomeshi. So they've come out and said that what he is saying that he does and what they've heard in allegations from the women, that it's not the same thing as what they do in, I guess, a more controlled environment. And as far as will more people come forward, for sure. I mean, I remember, you know, back, I mean, doing this for quite a while back in the 80s, doing investigative reports on allegations of abuse by priests in the Catholic Church. When we published those stories, more information came forward, more people came forward. That's a natural reaction to something like this. There is a you know, people out there who have been victimized, they do say that very few people actually make reports to the authorities.
Yet, why do you think a lot of people either are afraid to come forward, or when they do, they choose to remain anonymous? Is it to do with shame? Is it to do with protection of their families, or is it the fact that they're taking on somebody like a Gomeshi?
I think it's all of those things. People are concerned about having their private life spread around the internet, and that's a real concern these days. It's such a different world with the social media out there, and how things are, you know, replicated, passed around so quickly. And, you know, concerned about their family, concerned about their jobs. In many cases, I can understand if somebody, if you put yourself in their position, here they've been, they say they've been victimized, and perhaps it happened in such a situation where they had been with a person for a while and not just a one-time scenario, and they're embarrassed about that. They have a very good reason for why they stayed with the person, but now they have to go out and talk publicly about it. It must be a very nerve-wracking and embarrassing thing for them.
It seems to me that with this and with the Gamergate scandal, the amount of misogyny that we're hearing about has almost increased in the last couple of years rather than decreased. Do you think it's because more people, more women are starting to come forward with allegations and stories of abuse, or do you find that there's actually been an uptick in violence against women?
I am probably the last person to try to make an assumption of that. My gut feeling is that it's more people feel empowered to come forward, and not that there has been some increase. That would be almost an impossible statistical project to prove that. You just can't do that. I mean, when the police look at these things, they look at number of reports. So it's not something you cannot just look into the community and say there's more of this happening. You can say there's more being reported, though.
I wanted to ask you, because you're an investigative journalist, and I know also your colleague Robin was very instrumental in breaking the Rob Ford story. And to me, the Toronto Star seems to be one of the last true bastions of in investigative journalism. What do you make of the state of in investigative journalism as a whole, and why do you think the Star has survived while so many others have faltered?
Well, I mean, we at the Star, I mean, I was the one involved, Robin Doolittle and the Rob Ford story throughout it, and many others. I mean, for us, it's very important that we do more than provide what a blogger would provide or somebody who exists on Twitter. It's we have found at the Toronto Star that by doing this investigative journalism, of which we do a tremendous amount. I mean, I'm sitting here, editing a story completely unrelated to either of those topics that's going to run in the Monday paper on something else that's very important. We find that readers connect with that. It's still good that people get information from blogs and other social media, but people seem to want to have something that journalists with some training have vetted. I mean, I've been doing this for 30 years, and whenever we do stories, whether it's on problems with our air ambulance in Ontario, on charities across Canada, you name it, we get a lot of positive feedback from people, and we get people who are pushing back. I mean, as I was for 2 years at the center of the Rob Ford story, we got a lot of pushback from people who didn't like the questions that we were raising, but we still continue to raise them.
And yet, it seems that in this day and age, people are obsessed with not only celebrity, but scandal and salacious stories about celebrity. What do you make of that culture?
Well, I mean, it may seem like we're feeding that culture, but were we not to have written stories about Mr. Gomeshi, I think we would be criticized for that. People are... look, I have done stories that I consider to be very, very important stories about issues. For example, the plight of people who are intellectually challenged and how their parents are getting older and there's no good solution for who's going to look after them. That's a really, really important story. But when we do these stories, we do not get calls from other radio stations like yourself. We don't get calls from television stations. CNN doesn't call us. And so I really put it back on the rest of the media. When we do stories that may not involve a celebrity, but they're still important stories, why doesn't the other media, why don't the radio stations call us?
Yeah, that's definitely a fair point. And I wanted to ask you, because when this whole story came out, there was a post that talked about a law on the books in Canada, which says, no matter if it's consent or not, if a woman is harmed, or if there's harm to her body done during sex, then it cannot be consent. I'm wondering if you think this whole case, this whole conversation, will bring about any changes in the laws or at least how we look at violence against women?
Well, what you are referencing there is a Supreme Court of Canada decision which said you cannot consent to being hurt, and that's an important point in this, and I think that's to me that's where the conversation begins and ends. there's going to be, should Mr. Gomeshi ever be charged, that will be at the heart of all this, but what they're going to have to, the other, the Gomeshi side's going to have to deal with is what the Supreme Court of Canada said. They'll have to make new law to convince a court that, assuming that these allegations do make it into court, to show that somebody could consent to being choked, for example.
And I know Mr. Gomeshi just hired a hotshot criminal defense lawyer, and I've had a lot of people comment saying that they don't think the words Gomeshi found guilty will ever be uttered, nor do they think will they hear the phrase Gomeshi exonerated, that it will be somewhere in the middle. In your experience as an investigative reporter dealing with these sort of legal wranglings, what do you think will ultimately become of this?
Well, I would never try and predict what a court would do, and there isn't even there's no charges yet. I think it also will turn on who comes forward. The police are good at doing their job, quite good at these sort of cases, but the lawyer you mentioned has successfully achieved acquittals or dismissals on behalf of other high profile clients. So it's a difficult road ahead, and court cases take so long that I think you just have to see what happens. And as I said at the top of this part of the conversation, there is no court case yet involving criminal charges.
Do you think there's something to be said that the person defending Gomeshi is a woman?
Only that the person defending Mr. Gomeshi is a woman. I don't know. I don't know her. I know she has a great reputation, and people deserve and are entitled to the best representation in court, and then that's a great part of our system.
Well, it's a fascinating story that everyone seems to be glued to for the outrageousness of it, and I applaud you and Jesse Brown and all the other colleagues on doing a great job of reporting the story. Kevin Donovan, thanks so much for your time today.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
All right, cheers, bye-bye.
And that was Kevin Donovan from the Toronto Star. And you can follow him more on Twitter at _ Kevin Donovan, or you can also go to thestar.ca.
Hey, how about giving back to your community in a cool way while helping your family eat better? Well, you can. It's all in the name, Plant a Row, Grow a Row, an organization that helps you help others. Plant vegetables and donate them to your local food bank. Get how-to tips and more information about this innovative idea at www.growarow.org.
Are you going away to the North Central region of BC for winter fun? Heading off to Whale Mount, Prince George or Bakerville. Then find out about the arts, culture and heritage of these areas. Visit the local galleries, museums and attractions that help make the area what it is today. Check out the website goldenraven.ca. There is so much to see and do in that part of BC. It is full of rich history and long tales.
Well, earlier we opened the show with a song by Cold Specs off her new album, Neuroplasticity. Yesterday I had a chance to speak briefly on the phone with Cold Specs herself. Here is how she described the process of making her new album.
There?
Yep. And I am joined on the phone now by Cold Specs. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, nice to be on your show.
So your new album is Neuroplasticity. And I'm curious for you where the origin of this album came from for you.
The origin of the album name?
Well, just the origin of the album itself, how it came together.
Okay. I started writing it in a cottage in the UK, in Somerset, just in a town outside of Glastonbury. And I finished it in a studio in Montreal called Hotel de Tango. I went into a studio with three songs, and we fleshed the rest out there.
It's interesting. The album itself, the name
brings about science, brings forth the idea of science. I'm curious if you think if there's a certain science to the way you make music at all.
I chose the title Neuroplasticity only because I thought it would refer to a creative rewiring process. I thought it implied an aesthetic change, but it has nothing to do with science, really. I just kind of liked the name.
And I've read a lot about how for you, this album is an aesthetic change from I Predict a Graceful Expulsion. How would you describe that rewiring, and how conscious of a decision was that for you?
It's pretty conscious. I toured for a long time, and I got very bored with this freshness of the first record, so I made a very conscious decision to alter that. I wanted an expansive sound, a louder record. I wanted to have fun on stage, and so I went about doing that.
Now, I gotta ask, I heard that you recently got to play for Joni Mitchell at the Singers at her 70th birthday party. How did you come about to be invited for that, and the experience of playing for someone as iconic as Joni Mitchell?
It was Brian Blade, who was the musical director of the show, who had gotten in touch. He heard the music and liked it, and he invited me, so I went along to get it. It was a very nice experience. It's a memory I'll probably hold on to the rest of my life.
So you, one of your singles off Neuroplasticity is Abscisto. I really like the way that song fits together. What can you tell us about that track?
Abscisto is the first song I started writing and the last song I finished. It came together over a period of 6 months. Abscisto is Latin for withdraw or depart. I chose it as the first single because I thought it would be an appropriate thing to have, an appropriate song to introduce people to the new record. My favorite child.
And I know that your new single I just saw the video for it was well is Bodies at Bay. What about that track for you?
Oh, is that, I can hear you there.
Sorry?
Can you just repeat that? Can you just repeat that?
Yeah, sorry, I was just asking you about Bodies at Bay. I like the music video for that as well. What can you tell us about that song?
Bodies at Bay is the second single off the record. It's a song constructed from two different songs. I was listening to a lot of songs that were kind of like, I don't know, I wanted to have like a sweet verse and a chorus that punches you in the face. And so it's a wild song that'll probably make you vomit.
And I know you mentioned to that you wrote part of the album in Glastonbury, and I'm curious what sort of effect that you think that had on your writing process, because I read that you said, have you ever been to Glastonbury? It's a pretty fucked up place.
Yeah, Glastonbury is most famous for the Glastonbury Tour, which is an ancient hill. And on top of this hill, there's the ruins of this old church, maybe from the 12th century, St. Matthew's Church, St. Michael's. I'm not really sure on the name, but the town attracts a lot of pagans and spiritual hippies. It's been made to be, it's been corporatized. It's a corporate witch town.
And I know. What is it about certain places? You said you hold yourself up in a cabin. What is it about isolating yourself from the rest of the world for a bit that brings about great pieces of work?
It has really really nothing to do with isolating myself. It's more about isolating the songs and allowing them to grow in a place where no one is around, only because I don't want anyone to hear me making mistakes. And that's it, really.
So would you say there's a little bit of a perfectionist quality in what you try to do?
Not a perfectionist quality, but I have enough to be alone in order to make things. People don't need to hear it until it's done. In order for me to do that, I need to be alone.
And I know you also wrote with Ambrose Akin Mirzis for Blue Note, as well as Swans. How do you find collaborating with other musicians in comparison to making your own music?
It's a lot more fun. There's no real pressure. I get to just dive right into their stuff. It's a lot more enjoyable for me.
So for you, would you say that you have a favorite track off of your album?
Yeah, Absisto is my favorite child.
Well, it's a very great track. I've heard it myself, and the album is fantastic, and who knows, maybe we'll see another Polaris Prize nomination come your way. Cold Specs, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much for speaking to me. Have a good day.
You too. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye.
And that was Cold Specs, and I spoke to her on the road. We have another song here coming up from Cold Specs. This is Exit Plan.
A selection of limbs encased in doubt. And I'm full of love we could not grasp. All I got is loving grace. Death is swallowed up in victory. We'll be right back.
when you come undone.
In studio by a couple of goons, Ryan McNeil Bolton and Malcolm Masters. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, how are you guys?
Good.
You chucked up here in the rain, you're brave.
Yeah, I've never been up here before. It was confusing at first. But.
Yeah, it's a big, insane, not very good campus, but, you know, it is what it is, right? So, so you guys are the creators, stars of Goon.
Yes, we are.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you are right now involved in the, I guess it's a comedy coup competition for the CBC.
Yeah.
So, I guess we'll start the origin of Goon. Why did you? How did this creation come?
It came to be after we came out of school. We graduated into a drought. There wasn't a lot going on out there for acting, and we just wanted to take some control back. And we met each other through FDC, which is Fight Directors Canada, and we got along there well and came up with fights really well. And we just wanted to stay busy, so we got together and realized that ideas just kept pumping out, and that we wanted to, you know, create something, stay active, stay doing something.
Mm-hmm. And by connecting to each other through the stage combat world, we kind of, a part of the idea from the beginning was to create an idea that would allow us to practice our stage combat skills. So most of the idea came from Malcolm and Camden, who's our third goon.
Yeah.
And so they came up with this idea to create a show that would allow us to tell a story and get some laughs and make some fights as well.
Essentially about the bad guys, the guys you don't ever see. They get their butts kicked and that's it. That's it in the movie.
Well, Ryan, I know, if I remember, you were taking, was it Capoeira?
Yeah.
For a while. And you know, you obviously met during fight class. So, what makes violence funny?
That's part of the fun challenge.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, well, what it comes down to, we figured out the essence of comedy is somebody else's pain, really. I mean, that's where it all starts. Someone stubs their toe and you laugh at them. So we just kind of vamped that up with stuff that we like to do, you know?
Yeah.
We like to create fight scenes, big, crazy things, and it's funny seeing us get our butts kicked.
Yeah, yeah, it totally is. As long as it's funny how that is with comedy, and that it the root of it is like other people's misfortune, exactly, the slipping on the banana peel and stuff. Yeah. As long as the stakes are not real in the sense of, like, you know, people being genuinely injured.
Yeah.
So if you treat it in such a way that it's a gag and it's a means to an ends in terms of finding the humor and the comedy, that the you want to leave some of the edge in, because it's good to have a little bit of that shock value every once in a while, to have a moment where people kind of gasp almost, and then you address the comedy and they kind of can like relax and they can laugh about it.
Yeah, we definitely like pushing the envelope, that's for sure.
Vancouver's has had a lot of TV shows shot here over the year, but it's been a while since we've seen a homegrown TV show, so to speak. I think since kind of Da Vinci's went off the air, we haven't really had a Canadian show shot in Vancouver. Is that an important part of what you guys are trying to do? You're creating your show, you're from the city, but you also want to make your Canadian project in the city.
Absolutely. Yeah, from day one, we want to help the industry in Vancouver grow. Right, and it would be such a shame to have this great idea, have it go well, get funding for it, and then take it somewhere else, you know, because we all live here, we like being here, we want to stay here, and we know so many people involved in the industry, and why not work with your friends? One of the biggest sort of elements of Goons that has kept it going and kept its momentum and kept us engaged is that from day one, we just wanted to make sure that we only ever worked with people that we wanted to work with. So lots of friends through stage combat, friends from our classes at CAP. And I assume I would want to maintain that, you know? Because if you surround yourself in any kind of project with good people that you like working with, you will find a good product.
What makes Vancouver a good city for film? And, or, you know, for the industry, basically?
I think it's mostly the talent that's here. because there's been such a long history of film and TV in Vancouver, and especially for something like Goons, a show that that involves, you know, comedy and stage combat, and then this great story about kind of, you know, the underdog, the three thugs who are you know, who normally would just get blown over in the script. Like, they would be in the credits literally as goons 1, 2, and 3, and they would just kind of blow by, and they get, you know, beat up by the hero, and then you never hear from them again. And Vancouver's now got this great kind of, by doing shows like Smallville and Supernatural and now Arrow and The Flash, is as a huge, huge pool of action talent. There's so many great stunt guys here, guys that we would love to work with. You know, J.J. Abrams, who's been doing doing Arrow for a long time now, and Bam Bam down there as well. Rob Hader, like so many really top-notch stunt guys in this town.
Bam Bam was actually the head of the stunt union for a while here in town.
Yeah, I guess he was.
So, would you describe your show then as sort of that show with Alan Hocko meets Extras?
You could almost say that. I mean, it's like it's
Republic of Doyle.
We had an interesting one come up the other day that kind of described it really well. Kind of fit the elements. It's kind of like the Goons meets, or sorry, it's kind of, Goons is the Three Stooges meets the Expendables. You know, if you think about it in that way, where it has all these big characters, there's lots of action, but they're dumb, they get hurt all the time, and it's funny.
So are you saying you're going sort of, in terms of the comedy, you're over-the-top slapstick, or is it more sort of like Jackie Chan-style stunts?
I'd love to say it was Jackie Chan. Yeah, we're totally like Jackie Chan.
No big deal.
We pretty much do all the Jackie Chan tricks. It's definitely, slapstick isn't quite the right term, but it does have elements of that, and then it's extreme physical comedy. But we also deviate from that and just find situational comedy in the way the goons would handle a situation, as opposed to the way somebody else would handle a situation. Has developed a lot of comedy for us.
Given that the CBC is putting on this competition, if you guys win, how are you going to deal with the whatever network and producer interference that may come when you guys want to do things one way and they say, well, this is, you know, public TV, we kind of have to do it like this?
Yeah, that's a tough question because we've never had to face it before, but I think it'd be a good thing to have, a good challenge to face. Mm-hmm.
It would definitely bring some experience, you know? I mean, like, because at the end of the day, like, we're just three actors who wanted to make a show, right? And we came up with some stuff that we thought was funny, and we're like, hell, let's shoot this thing. And now it's reached a point where it's quite developed, and we have a lot of good ideas and a lot of good content that we think we can apply to a television show, but we're also open to collaborating, and we don't want to let go of the essence of what Goons is. And we think that we're not worried about censorship or anything like that. I mean, if at the end of the day the content isn't suitable for CBC, if they don't like, there's nothing in it directly that would cause them to say, you know, we need to edit this out, it's appropriate for television, we've created it that way on purpose. It may not necessarily be appropriate for CBC. I mean, it depends on what they're looking for, but my impression is that they're really looking for edgy stuff right now. They're looking for things that are different, because the Comedy Coupe model came out of their CineCoupe contest, which is essentially the same thing but for feature film. And the project that won CineCoupe was Wolf Cop. So it's like a B-level slasher flick about a police officer who's a werewolf. So, you know, a story of three goons who like to get in fights is not too over the top.
It's not too far-fetched.
There's been a lot of talk recently, you know, there's the Netflix tax that might be introduced, and there's a whole other conversation going on about the state of CanCon, homemade, like Canadian content, film and television in sort of the overall filmdom of what you see in theaters on television.
Yeah.
What is your opinion of where that is right now?
Well, I think that we've reached a point where certain Canadian content creators are realizing that the model as it has been is not necessarily working. But so they're trying to push the boundaries. Like CBC is headed in the right direction with new shows like Strange Empire. So it's this dark, dramatic, edgy period show that, you know, while not necessarily the kind of show that is capturing the right audience, it's definitely, they're stretching their boundaries, you know, they're moving beyond, you know, Corner Gas and This Hour Has 22 Minutes, like, so, and I think part of what happened was that Canadian content became so fearful of being similar to American content that it's possible to lose sight of just telling good stories. And it's like, well, if you're telling a good story and it happens to be like an American show, who cares? It's a good story. People will watch it, and they'll know that it's Canadian. Or maybe they won't know that it's Canadian, but it doesn't, like, why does that have to be the most important thing? We're just here to tell good stories. And if it's a Canadian show, awesome. That's great success for Canada and for Canadian creators and all that. But
so on that note then, about Canadians being fearful of being too much like Americans, does that mean that you think there's either a overabundance of originality or a fearful of originality because we're shying away from making edgy stuff and going for more of the dull stuff and basically reverse engineering ourselves to be less like the Americans to the point where we're reducing our originality and intellectual creative output?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're kind of, you know, we're hamstringing ourselves in trying to be a particular type of content. And so, whereas, like, the reason we're trying to be different from every other producer, every other sort of, you know, type of story or show that gets created, but the reason most of those other shows are out there and are working is just because it's good storytelling. So what we've ended up doing is we're trying to not be like the good stories that are being told.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of this, we're shooting ourselves in the foot, and it's all from coming from a place of genuine well-wishing and people wanting to create stuff that is unique to us. But you know, why don't we just create something that's uniquely good, and not have to fit in, you know, the show doesn't have to be about hockey or involve RCMP officers or it doesn't have to be
take place on a prairie town.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Throw some corn.
Yeah. We need to sort of move beyond that and just and it's like if it's set in, because, like, I mean, when a show is set in New York, an American show, they don't spend the whole time talking about the Rangers and the Empire State Building and how, you know, not every second scene takes place next to the Statue of Liberty. Like, they don't do that.
Yeah.
So why do we have to do that? You can set a show in Vancouver and people will appreciate that it's Vancouver without having to, you know, shove it in people's faces at the cost of storytelling.
So what makes a good story for you then? In, you know, in terms of the sort of the content you watch, what attracts you to certain ideas?
Just, you know, characters that you want to see you move through life, however that happens to be. A character that's interesting to you that either you can relate to or that's so completely different that you can't relate to them and you want to discover more about it and to see how they navigate a world, whatever world you create, whether it's like a real world or a fictional world. So it all comes down to good characters and then putting those characters in interesting situations. And there's no, I mean, there is a formula for that, you know. There's many different sort of like literature formats, like the hero's journey, you know, which is basically Star Wars, or Star Wars is the hero's journey, I should say, and the other way around. So there are formats for basic storytelling, and it's because they're good. It's an interesting way of seeing someone, you know, have a goal and go for it and either fail or succeed or fail and then succeed, and you know, however you go about doing that, it just depends on what kind of characters you want to create and exactly what events you want to put them through. And then for us, you know, also is finding, you know, finding laughs along the way.
Given that you guys work so closely together, what is the writing process like in terms of, you know, if you know, one of you wants this and someone else wants that. Where how do you solve problems and figure out what direction you want to take it?
It's kind of like a spitball effect, I would think. A snowball effect, you know, you get a main idea, somebody tosses in the pool, and the other guy's like, oh yeah, I like that, okay, let's get it on its feet, start working through it, and then the guys will discover something else funny, and they'll be like, hey, can we try this? Like, yeah, let's try that and see how that works. If it doesn't work, just chuck it aside, but we got it in the can anyway.
Yeah, we've developed a really good sort of writing process where we just kind of sit around and we just talk. We just talk and try and figure out funny ideas.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be funny if this happened?
Yeah, exactly. That's like half of the show is born out of that. It's like, man, wouldn't it be funny if such and such, and then so and so shows up, but it's actually this guy, and then
that's good.
Yeah, and then we all laugh, and if that happens, then we're like, awesome, we've hit something. Because that's like, at the end of the day, I have no idea what's truly funny to Dan McPeak, and if I was to try and tailor a joke to Dan McPeak, I would fail. I would fail at that. But I know what's funny to me, and Malcolm can tell me what's funny to him, and Cam can tell me what's funny to him. So we can put those together and find stuff that makes us laugh, and at the end of the day, there's going to be some people out there who share a sense of humor.
So people almost make shows then for themselves rather than anybody else.
Oh, you have to. You absolutely have to. There's no other way to create content. Like, you must create art for yourself. Because otherwise it's contrived,
that's
right?
That's essentially what it came out of. This show came out of fighting. It came out of getting your butt kicked and creating that. So that is definitely where the show came from. So that's exactly like you said.
And that was Ryan Bolton and Malcolm Masters from Goon. Be sure to check them out. You'll notice that was a slightly, or you may not know this, but that was a slightly abbreviated version of our interview because it went on for an additional 10 minutes. I will post the full interview on the Endeavors Facebook group, so you can check it out there. And I apologize, but we are running a little short on time for to air the full thing. But yeah, the full version will be up online. My thanks to Ryan Bolton and Malcolm Masters from Goon. My thanks to Kevin Donovan of the Toronto Star, and of course, Cold Specs. Stay tuned. My guest next week will be Alan Doyle of Great Big Sea talking about his new book. And Big John Bates will be here to play some tunes for us. Stay tuned for Jambalaya. We're going to take you out with Cold Specs. Absisto, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.
will strike you